land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to Yada Yada. As we typically do, Kirk, we'll start with a few items in the news. Small item, but can you imagine how you would feel if, let's say that your country decided that it would declare war on Russia, which is what we have essentially done. Right? Mm-hmm. Sending billions of dollars of weapons to go kill Russians. We're just using the Ukrainians as our proxy. And because of that, the Chinese would say, you know, that's that violates our morality. And therefore, since we have large investments in the state of California, we're going to confiscate your house, Kirk. You may not have had anything whatsoever to do with the decision to go to war. Maybe totally against it. Doesn't matter. We're going to take your house because, well, we think we should do that. So what does the United States do? We're going and confiscating the yachts of wealthy Russians. Not because they had anything to do with the decision to go to war, just because we like the term oligarch. Now, I don't think there's one American in probably 100,000 that knows what the term oligarch is, or that an oligarchy was the only stable form of democracy in world history. You know, if you really understand what an oligarchy is, an oligarchy is when only those who have a vested interest in the society can make decisions regarding the society, and they make all the decisions. So that in a true oligarchic democracy, the people who make things, grow things, sell things,
produce things,
they decide if the country is going to go to war, if they're going to risk their fortune and their land and their sons to go fight an enemy. They decide how much is going to be spent and for what and on whom. And so it's not like this modern incarnation of a democracy where people can go to the ballot box and vote themselves money that is literally confiscated, stolen from others, such that ultimately a democracy dies because those who are parasites suck too much life out of those who are productive. Might sound harsh, but that's the reality. And in oligarchy, that does not happen. You can't decide how much you can steal from somebody else. You can only decide how much of what you have you're willing to give to the government for the purposes of the government's business. That is an oligarchy. The United States, as it began, was an oligarchy.
And it had property, right?
All stable governments are. If you aren't vested in the system, you don't get to vote in the system. Anyway, that's. I just think it's grotesquely immoral that we would go confiscate and gleefully confiscate the yachts of those that we are labeling oligarchs. There was an item in the news today that was talking about how at the World Economic Forum that the consequence of the lockdowns and the deprivation of livelihood that occurred worldwide as liberal government leaders deprived people of their rights have caused supply lines to be upended, economies to be trashed, currencies to become worthless. And we're only beginning to see the horrors of all of this. We're going to have world famine, and we're going to have revolutions. It's going to be the worst time in human history. And it's derived from, largely, the mismanagement of the COVID pandemic. Guys like Fauci, who were sanctimonious and stood up there and said the science dictates that we force people to stay at home, that we force people to give up their personal freedom and only essential workers can go to work. This is an ignoramus as it relates to economics, mental health, human nature. And so by following his advice, we ended up crippling our nation and the world. And this wasn't a surprise. I'm not Monday morning quarterbacking this. This is exactly what I said at the very beginning of the epidemic, that we're going to do vastly more harm than good. And now the World Economic Forum, after all of the devastation of that and then doubled down Biden, decides that he's going to instigate a war in the Ukraine so that he can play warrior president and give billions of dollars of weapons to the Ukraine to kill Russians, that the sanctions that were placed on Russia have grossly exacerbated what was already a death spiral in the world's economies. But the World Economic Forum says, that very mess we made, now you should trust us to solve it for you. I don't think so. Do you know that with all of these sanctions, you know what the strongest currency in the world is? The currency that has increased in value 40% against the dollar since January.
No, I don't.
The Russian ruble.
I thought that's what you were going to say. I just well.
Would not that be the thing that you would have thought would have been different? If you look at the value of the ruble to the dollar before Russia invaded the Ukraine and its value now, it's much, much higher now. So we plunged the value of the ruble immediately after the invasion, but since January, its rate of success parallels the U.S. rate of inflation and lack of success. I was sickened. Of course, we're all sickened by an 18-year-old. Going in and murdering, 20 children and teachers in a school in Vivaldi, Florida, Texas. The thing that was far sicker is that the moral midget that we have in the White House came out and must have said in God's name about 10 times, I can assure you that Roman Catholic does not know God's name. And every time he'd say God's name, it was to blame the gun or blame the gun lobby, as he calls it. The gun lobby is insignificant in Washington. I mean, it's the amount of money that they spend and the influence they have compared to other lobbies is absolutely inconsequential. And I can assure you that the gun lobby and the gun had nothing to do with what happened in Uvalde, Texas. What happened there is the same thing that that has happened in every one of these mass shootings. And it goes back 10 years when I first reported on this, and I said there is a common denominator in all of the mass shootings. It's not just that the perpetrator was insane, mentally deranged. But in virtually all cases, they were using psychiatric drugs. And this is harder and harder for us to establish now because the HIPAA rules and the disclosure rules are such that it's very difficult to know any one individual that is using mind-altering drugs. But you know what the percentage is of the nation? 40 million Americans are taking psychiatric drugs for one form of mental disorder or another. That does not include the tens of millions of Americans that are taking painkillers of one sort or another. That is not counting the tens of millions of Americans that are on illegal drugs like heroin and fentanyl and cocaine. That does not include the tens of millions of Americans that are hooked on alcohol and are abusing alcohol and are drugged out of their mind with alcohol. Just on mind-altering psychiatric drugs, 40 million Americans. Was that 1 in 8?
That's staggering.
Since it's not being taken by 3-year-olds of adult Americans, and it's not being taken significantly by seasoned citizens of teens and early 20s and 30s. What do you think the number is? Not 1 in 8. I bet it's 1 in 4. Yeah. And if you add in those other drugs, what do you think it is?
More than 1 in 2? Yeah.
And we're drugged out of our mind. That's why the prophecy in Yeshaya 17 and 18 uses intoxication to describe America. But beyond the psychiatric drugs, I don't want to limit it there. We as a nation, America, and I would say the West, has created this problem, and we don't want to address what caused it. We've so liberalized our schools with political correctness, with progressive thought, that there's no longer any accountability, no sense of responsibility, no right, no wrong. Evidence and reason no longer matter. And if you can't think, if you're not rational, if there is no right and wrong, if the things that are the most perverted are the things that are most accepted, then you as a society are going to have this become commonplace. And there is nothing that will stop it. Because we aren't smart enough anymore to remove the negative influence of liberal education. But that's our problem. We've dumbed down generations where they can no longer think. And of course, we have the 7 hours a day that the average person in the world spends online playing computer, either in social media, tending to be somebody else, or as a voyeur looking at somebody else's life, or playing a first-person shooter game where you get to reboot when you're killed or you killed somebody else, so the goal of the game is to kill someone. We're really in serious trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is disintegrating very rapidly, and I can assure you that none of the politicians and virtually no one in the media has a clue as to what the problem is or how we go about solving it. I don't know if you know, but we're at the cusp of having another epidemic. While COVID now is ripping through the world again. And you don't hear anybody talking about it because they don't want to admit that everything they did in the name of science turned out to be counterproductive, that we ruined our economy, we ruined our supply lanes, that we put the world on the precipice of world hunger, of famine. We accomplished nothing but made lives worse. And so as COVID rises, nobody even wants the vaccine because the vaccine had too short a life. The vaccine has no value on the newest strains. The mortality rate turned out to be exactly as I said it was going to be, 1 in 1,000. They're tossing away billions of vaccines. There's no more mask mandates. You know, they don't want to talk about it, but it is exceedingly pervasive. There's not even any reason to do testing anymore. But there is a new virus. You know what the one is? This is sick. It's monkeypox. You know how we get monkeypox? Somebody in Nigeria.
No, I don't.
Some likely a Christian in Nigeria. Could have been a Muslim, but likely a Christian in Nigeria. I think they're two-thirds, three-quarters of the population there. It's having sex with a monkey.
Oh.
Yep.
God.
That's how it goes across the genetic line. So welcome to bestiality and the world of Christianity and Black Lives Matter. But right now, monkeypox is racing across the world. Germany alone is trying to order 40,000 vaccine doses as a precaution against monkeypox. It's a horrible disease. By the way. So we are dealing with an interesting world. Of course, we talked 2 weeks in a row about the impending release of the Supreme Coast court overturning Roe v. Wade. And, you know, I've talked very honestly about it. Roe v. Wade should be overturned because of the fact it was not constitutional in the first place. It is either a state right or an individual right, not a national right. If you don't adhere to the rule of law, then you have no law. You're just pure opinion, and you can't govern that way. There have to be standards. And so my view is that it is either a state right or an individual right, and have long said that the first trimester is sad, but it is something that is likely the choice of the two would-be parents, and the third trimester, it's murder. And what you do in the second is of serious concern. But the thing that really upsets me about the whole thing, of course, is is all the women out there saying, my body, my choice, as if they don't want anybody else having influence over their body, but somebody needs to, because obviously they have no control over it, otherwise they wouldn't have an unwanted pregnancy. That's something to think about next time you think that you should go out and parade around and say that my body, my choice. Why couldn't you be responsible for your body in the first place? There is an issue of all of this that no one wants to talk about. But the rate of abortion each year among Caucasian women is 6. Per thousand. 6 per thousand Caucasian women each year have an abortion. 24 per thousand African American women have an abortion. An African American woman is 4 times more likely to have an abortion each year. Again, we talk about percentages, and if it were 10% more likely, you'd say it's probably an irrelevant number. 20%, mm-hmm. You begin to talk about it. 30%, okay, that's significant. 40%, very significant. 50%, you need to pay attention to this. It's serious. Twice at 100%? Well, that's something seriously wrong with one group versus another. But this isn't 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 or 50%. It's not 100%. It's four times.
Mm-hmm.
Hispanic women and in Asian women, Hispanic, they are 12 per thousand. So Hispanic women are half as likely to have an abortion as a black woman and twice as likely to have one as a Caucasian woman. When you have numbers like this, then you have a cultural difference in those communities. This is not a matter of genetics. This is not a matter of what the skin color is on the outside. It's about the culture and the irresponsible nature of a culture, which is four times more likely to deal with an unwanted pregnancy, with the inability to control one's body by killing the fetus. That is something to think about, is it not?
Well, I guess.
All right. I would like to turn to what we were considering a week ago. We had read a very profound statement, and we're beginning to comment on it. It was a fairly long statement. I'll reread it, and then we can continue to talk about it. It says, a prophet from among your midst, from your brethren, similar to me, Yahweh, your God, will raise up and position to take a stand which establishes and affirms you. To him, I want you to actually and continually listen. Before we go on, that's just Dabarim words corrupted to Deuteronomy 18:50. Okay, he's a prophet, a Nabi. There was only about 40 of them. From your midst, that means he's going to be a Israelite. From your brethren, emphasizing again that there will be a family connection to the descendants of Jacob. This person is not going to be a Gentile. You can be assured. Similar to me. How many people could claim a similarity, or not them claim, how many people would Moshe claim are similar to him? Went in to Mitzrayim with Yahweh to liberate at least 600,000 slaves. Not only was that, I'm not even sure that is the lead item on his resume. He's the guy that delivered the Torah to us.
Yeah.
And then he's the guy that explained it to us in the book of Devarim. And all the while herded this miserable herd of cats out of Mitzrayim, the crucibles of religious and political oppression, and into the promised land, or at least to the promised land. I mean, that's a heck of a resume. And he did all of that after he was 80 years old.
That's now, pretty remarkable.
Okay. He at one time in his life was a leader of the government of Mitzrayim. It's likely, because everybody in the royal family as a male would have been an officer in the military.
Mm-hmm.
So government, leader, officer in the military, prophet, liberator, defender of his people. You know another guy like that?
Well, I know another one's got good credentials, but he's pretty sharp.
Yeah, Doug.
Would way be out of the league. Yeah, Doug.
Yeah,
no,
yeah, that
yeah,
would be yeah. It. Yeah, it's a list of one. There's only one person who Moshe would say, this fellow's like me.
That's the one, yeah.
He's the one. Okay? Nobody else. Similar to me. Yahweh, your God. Not Jesus, not Allah, not Hashem, not Adonai, not the Lord. Yahweh, your God. If Yahweh's not your God, well, you're hurting for gods. If Yahweh's not your God, this person's meaningless to you because there is nothing for you. Yahweh, your God, will raise up and position to take a stand which establishes and affirms you. Not going to come and establish a new religion. He's not going to affirm and establish Gentiles. This can't be Jebus, who did that for the Roman Catholic Church. He's establishing and affirming Israelites. What is the basis of religion? Is that God got so pissed off that those dastardly Jews killed him that he deprived them of heaven and transferred every promise that he had made to them to the Gentile church. That is the basis, the very foundation of Christianity. This says exactly the opposite, that it can't be the Christian Christ. Says it's going to affirm you. He's speaking to Israelites, your brethren, from among your midst. It is a Israelite that is going to affirm Israel. Well, tell me, who did that? Who's the guy that unified Israel, that brought them into Jerusalem as their capital? Who's the one that defended them from every enemy?
Once again.
No. Jebus didn't do that. Stone. That's the one he's talking about here. Of course, the Muslims will claim that this is speaking of Muhammad. Are you crazy? What part of this speaks to Muhammad?
Please.
He will raise up and take a position, a stand which establishes and affirms you. Kub, la, ata. He will validate and confirm, elevating the status to encourage and restore you. Well, Doe took over. Things were pretty bad. I mean, Saul got his head literally handed to him.
Mm-hmm.
As did his son. Israel was in dire straits. And when he returns, Israel will be all but destroyed. But not afterwards. To him, I want you to actually and continually listen. Well, can you please tell me the list of people that are Israelites, that are prophets, that are among your brethren, that have been raised up by God to take a stand which establishes and affirms Israel, to whom we can actually and continually listen? Who was the most prolific writer amongst all Israelites? To whom do we have the greatest trove of Dead Sea Scrolls? Dode. The author of the Mizmor and the Mishal. Dode is the only one we can continue to listen. You sure as can't listen to Jesus, because guess what? Jesus wrote nothing down. Mm-hmm. Not a word. And there was no one with him that wrote anything. But in the case of Yahweh's prophets, it's the prophet who writes things down. If Yosha was supposed to be a prophet, he'd have written stuff down in Hebrew, and it would have been retained for us to read. But there's nothing. So you can't listen to him. So we're back to one person. Dote. But I can be fair. Yirmiyah, Yashaya. Boy, they had a lot to say. Yaketzel, Hosha, Zachariah, Malachi. They all had a lot to say. And we can all listen to what they had to say. I'm not sure, however, that the term will raise up and position to take a stand which establishes and affirms you, though would be correct with any of them. Because their primary message is, you and your religion are disgusting.
Yeah.
He wasn't affirming them. He was doing exactly the opposite to these prophets. And so it is it's something we should consider when we're trying to come up with this list.
And no one listened to Yashaya. He turned around and said, nobody there.
Nobody there. Oh, yeah, no one. That ain't true today.
No.
I'll tell you, we're listening.
Not today. Yeah. Yes, sir.
This is consistent with everything which you requested of Yahweh, your God, in Chorab, during the day of the assembly, when you said, never again let me hear the voice of Yahweh, my God, nor let me witness this intense fire anymore, lest I die. Sabarim 18:16. Wow. Okay. So I get it. At first I'd say, how could you be so stupid? You got the creator, the God of the universe, and he's talking directly to you. The beautiful, warming, glowing, enlightening fire on the top of that mountain. And you hear this rich tenor of God's voice, and he's speaking lovingly and caringly to you. And your response is, uh-oh, don't want any of that. Get him away from me. And the reason that you can't say that they were wrong, certainly not my approach, I gotta tell you, but you can't claim that they're wrong because God said they were right. God says, you're right, I won't do it again. What does that mean? This tells you what that means, that God has chosen right then and forevermore to communicate through an individual, one of us. God says, you're right, I'm not going to speak to you directly with my big booming voice and the fire because it intimidates you. And that's not my goal. I want to embrace you, not intimidate you. And so I'm going to speak to you through one of you. This is a message given by the one Yahweh chose to speak for him at this time. And it's about the one that Yahweh chose to speak for him in the midst of the entire human experience. 3,000 years after we were exiled from the Garden of Eden and 3,000 years before we were allowed back in. One person then, one person again, one person in our immediate future. That is God's way. When God spoke, now this is a much lesser role. This prophecy is not about the last witness. It's not about the choder. It's not about the knacker, but it is in a way, indirectly. God wants to get the attention of his people before he returns. He wants there to be a day of reconciliations, plural. And right now, amongst Jews, particularly Jews and Israel, there'd be somewhere between slim and none. And so God picked an individual to communicate with his people because that's what he said he was going to do. He is never going to talk to them directly again. I think that will change upon his return, but even on his return, he's not the King of Kings, Dodis. Even upon his return, the one who is counseling the people is not Yahweh, it's Dod. So even upon his return, God's going to stay with this plan. He picks one person, and it's that person through whom he communicates. And now, there is a final witness, a Bashar, a herald, a Malak, a messenger, a Nacker, an informed and observant, responsive foreigner, a Choder, a sucker from the original rootstock. It is God's way to pick someone to communicate. I was concluding the most difficult chapter I have written in the past 21 years this afternoon. And I decided that because for the last week that I've been working on it, my wife continues to ask me, can you read something of the new chapter to you? And I kept on saying, no, I'm struggling with it. I'm not in a position to do that. And she's very nice. She gives me the space. And this morning I said, I've completed the chapter. I want to read to you the last five or six pages, because there's an ending that was very surprising. And I began to read, and I explained to her, this is what the text says, and then began to explain the text. And she says, you know, that's why you're doing this. He says, you know, I spend every day reading the Torah. I love the Torah. I love the prophets. I understand them, and I also know the insides. It's when God's criticizing my people, I know exactly what we do that is irritating him. This is my life. I said, but I never would have seen the things that you pointed out unless you had shared them. And that's why it's you, not me or anyone else. And that is how God works. You may not like it. You might want a different solution. You might want to pick somebody else. But I'm just telling you that is God's choice. And it's how he, through experience, has found that it must be. So it's consistent with everything which you requested. He's still speaking to Yisrael. Of Yahweh, your God, in Chorab. That's where the Torah was revealed. During the day of the assembly, when you said, never again, I do not want to hear the voice nor see the great light, the fire of Yahweh, my God, lest I die. Therefore, Yahweh said to me, that's actually better. They have appropriately conveyed their preference. So, our natural instinct is to say, what's wrong with you dunderheads? No, listen to God. Listen to God. He's great. Wow. He's one. Yeah. But no, God says, no, they're right. Yeah. They're right. And I'm going to, forevermore, well, at least for the 6,000 years of the human experiment, I'm going to pick an individual. Sometimes I'll pick two. There's two witnesses in the last days. There was an overlap between Yeshaya, Hosha, Yirmiyah, a little period there where there was an overlap of prophets. Dod and Nathan were both prophets, although we don't know a lot about Nathan other than the majestic conveyance of of Second Samuel 7. But for the most part, there was one. And God says, I understand. Their preference is actually better. So, I will raise up and establish a prophet for them from among their brothers, similar to you. Yeah. This is God speaking now. God speaking to us through his prophets so we can read what he said in first person. We can articulate it. It's the best of all worlds. I can choose to spend my time studying these words, as can you. I can choose to listen to him. I can choose to observe what he said, or I can choose to close the book and not. It's perfect. God only shouts when I shout out his words. And then it's because I want him to shout. I want to hear him shout. Sometimes he speaks softly. We set the tone. The words are his. The inflection is ours. It's a marvelous arrangement. And God says, I will put my words in his mouth, and he will convey them, everything which, for the benefit of the relationship, I instruct him. Okay, let's think about the candidates for that as well. He's a prophet. So as a prophet, fires the words that he wrote and he conveyed to us. We know what Yahweh inspired Dode to write. He was among the three greatest prophets. I would put Moshe, Dode, and Yeshaya as the three great prophets.
Yeah.
We know what God inspired him to write. God, he did those things. But it's interesting with the prophets. God did not say that everything that comes out of his mouth will be inspired by me. He just says, I will put my words in his mouth. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will convey them, everything which, for the benefit of the relationship, I instruct him. It did not say that everything that came out of Dode's mouth would be truthful. Dode said some stupid stuff. He didn't say anything stupid when he's writing a mashal or a proverb, a psalm, or a mizmor. Then it's all inspired, word for word, what God told him to say. Everything that Yahweh instructed him to say for the benefit of the relationship, he wrote down and conveyed to us. So prophets aren't perfect people. It's that their prophecies are perfect.
Good point.
Now, of these people, there were really very few that God instructed. Yahweh instructed Moshe. That's no doubt about it. He not just articulated the Torah. He taught Moshe the Torah. That's why Dabarim is as it is. There are some others that Yahweh clearly taught, but the list is short. And the most telling on that list is his son, Dode. And so this is somebody that Yahweh instructed. I don't think that Yahweh instructed the nephesh that resided within Yosha. I think he directed the nephesh that's inside of Yosha. We had a brief conversation about it this evening, Kirk, and I received a nice letter from Jackie this evening. She has recently received the translation of Mizmor 88, the hardest that I've ever done. It's the chapter that just concluded. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult because the voice throughout, from beginning to end, is the nephesh of Yahweh.
Yeah.
And trying to understand the nephesh of Yahweh and how the nephesh of Yahweh resides within Yosha and then goes and is separated and endures the separation of Sheol and then reunites with Yahweh and then runs a commentary on how frustrated he is with how his people have responded to what he has done. It is an exceedingly interesting, and if you have to be fully into this to deal with the detail of this, because it's a complicated concept. But as a probe, and that's really how Yahweh used his nephesh. Yahweh can't enter our three-dimensional realm, so he can't be a lamp. But he can project his conscious awareness into an individual to serve as the lamp. And still smell, see, hear, touch, feel. Everything that's happening to that lamp, that individual. And likewise, he can do the same thing as Sheol. He can't go to the place of separation, but he can send, dispatch a probe there that is a living, conscious projection of himself, which can send back all of the data so that he knows exactly what's happening and how torturous it is. And so Yahweh is not teaching that probe, but directing the probe. And the communication is primarily from the probe back to Yahweh. And so this, I am instructing him of what to say, can't be of Yosha, in whom that probe resided.
Get it?
This is not written that way. The Mizmor 88 is. This is not. And it shall come to be that as an individual who will not listen to my words, which he shall declare in my name, I myself will seek it of him and hold him accountable for it, requiring it of him. Devarim 18:19. Moshe, that could be said about Moshe, clearly, that, God can say, I put my words in his mouth. Yahweh said he was going to do it. He did it. Yahweh instructed him. What he said was for the benefit of the relationship. And God is going to hold all of us accountable for knowing what Moshe said, because Moshe revealed the terms and conditions of the covenant. He revealed the invitations to meet of the Moed Mikre, of which we need to attend and we need to accept. So this is absolutely true of Moshe. So who else wrote so profoundly that God's going to hold us accountable for what he said and inspired through him? And how is God going to hold us accountable for that? Because Dod is returning as Messiah, Shepherd, and King. That's why. No one else is returning as Messiah, Shepherd, and King, only Dod. And since he is in charge, we're going to be accountable for knowing what he said, what he represents. The reason that the mission that became Yada Yahweh began with a single word in a single passage. 2 Samuel, 7th chapter, 11th verse, beginning with Asher, which is a relational term which tells us that there's the proper path to walk to receive the benefits of the relationship and get the most joy out of life. Asher. That when we were directed to that, little did I know that it would appear in six different volumes of the Yada Yahweh series, and that it would be the very fulcrum upon which God's plan pivots. It is about Dod and Yahweh's relationship with him initially in life, taking him from the sheepfold and making him the leader of his people, providing him with the most wonderful of homes while Yahweh had essentially none. And then taking him such that a speck of his DNA will be reconstituted and he will be brought back to life and his kingdom established forever. It is the most powerful prophecy in the world, and it is that prophecy that helps us understand specifically why God is talking about this man. It is that prophecy that helps us understand the central role the Son of God plays in God's unfolding story, and how Dodd represents really all of Israel. He represents the covenant. He is a product of the Torah. And it's when we come to appreciate what Dodd means to Yahweh, how Dodd said, I got it. You don't want me to govern you directly. You don't want me to inspire you directly. You don't want me to talk to you directly. You don't want to see me in your face. I get it. That's all good. So I'm going to pick a man. Well, the whole ceremony about Yahweh choosing Dodd, him explaining that his criterion is different than ours, and how he anointed him as the Messiah immediately at 8 years old, and then brought his spirit upon him to inspire him, made him the leader of his people. This is God saying, I get it. That's best, and we'll do it that way. He's speaking of the single most important life in human history, the life of Dodd. That is Yah's answer for yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And it's not until you have an appreciation for who he is and what he represents that you really have a full appreciation of what the covenant is, the value of the Moed Mikre, the nature of the relationship Yah wants to establish with us, and his timeline for our redemption. It is Dodd, after all, who is being brought back with blood on his fingertips to sprinkle it on the Kapporah, the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant, to fulfill the promises of reconciliation so God and his people can be reunited, reestablished, reaffirmed, just as this prophecy foretells. It is a magnificent slice of our history foretold in these words. We were well through the commentary on this when our program ended, and I want to pick up with, here we are now, it's the program is two-thirds over, and true to form, Kirk, we're going to pick up with where we actually left off last week.
It was
I stand I rightly accused, but Yahweh and my team of wonderful editors had me take this word out, but it was a chapter that I wrote for Volume 7. A number of translations were, it seemed to say to me that God was repetitive, and I find him repetitive, but since repetitive is kind of has a pejorative tone to it, and somebody is repetitive, I said, you know, you don't need to be repetitive. You've told me that story already. Well, God really
is good teaching.
It is, but that's the best way to teach. I didn't look at it as a pejorative because I'm repetitive. We've just repeated that prophecy because I think it is that important for us to know. And the more times we hear it, the more different ways we speak about it, the more likely it is that all of us are going to benefit from it, understand it, retain it, be able to teach it and share it. So repetition, I think, is a really good thing. I thought that what God was saying, I'm repetitive, isn't that good? But the editors didn't think so. That I have and they're right, by the way, I have a tendency to be so comfortable with Yahweh that I will say things that strike
scares
most
them.
People as, did you really say that about God?
What? What?
Well, yes, that's a good thing. He strikes me as exceedingly approachable and friendly. And so long as we get his name right and render his words accurately and don't change him into some kind of a pagan god, he's really pretty accommodating.
Pretty.
Yeah. So, Kirk, whether it was Adam or Noah, Abraham or Jacob, Samuel or Dodd, Yao has been consistent. With very rare exceptions, mm-hmm. he has chosen one or two individuals with whom to engage and through whom to communicate to Yisrael. And he seldom, if ever, works alone. Yahweh does not want to intimidate us. He doesn't want to have anyone worship him. He is a complete advocate of free will, and he wants nothing more than to develop a familial relationship. We approach Yahweh, our God, through evidence and reason, by choice. Not because he is so visible and so intense that he can't be denied.
Point taken.
This is the reason we were created. This is the explanation for the covenant. Now, this predicted individual, he would be a Yisraelite. He would be a prophet, of which there were 40. Each left an indelible written history to explain the past and predict the future. Each prophet is irrefutably and undeniably inspired by God, such that everything they wrote remains accurate. Of these men, and Nabi is masculine, there were female prophetesses, but this one is a Nabi. It's a masculine term. Only one rises to the level of Dote. Upon his return, Yahweh will be arriving with his chosen Masiach, Malak, Ra'ah, and Ben. Masiach is Messiah. Malak is king. Ra'ah is shepherd. Ben is son. It is to the list, to the lyrics of his psalms and the prose of his proverbs that God wants us to listen. Now, the fact is, God mm-hmm. listens to Dote. There are not a lot of people that God say, I listen to him. He could sing for me all day long.
He quotes him.
Yep. Of the four Zoroah, this cannot be Moshe because he is predicting another. It cannot be Yahusha since he wrote nothing for us to read. And therefore, we cannot listen to him. And it cannot be Yada because he is a messenger and not a prophet. And as for Yashaya, Yirmiyah, Zechariah et al., there were many, not one. Yahweh revealing himself through individuals like Dode rather than to large gatherings of illiterate people throughout time is actually a much better approach. It is the best way for everyone, no matter when or where they were born, to know Yahweh, to read his Torah, to attend his Mikrei, and participate in his Bereth. Like, I've been doing it now for 21 years. Many of you listening have done it for over a decade. It's a marvelous experience. We can do it collectively. We can do it individually. In this manner, we are all given direct access to God. We have no filter. We can listen to God speak to us directly. First person. And are able to study the revelations his prophets provided whenever time permits. However, with availability comes responsibility. Because Yahweh has made his testimony available to all of us, and because he has proven that he has inspired his prophets, God will require proof of it, at least among those who wish to live with him. Without knowing what Yahweh revealed, we cannot be right about him. And unless we are correct, there is no life beyond the one we are living. By saying that the Nabi will come from your midst and from your brethren, we are assured that he is a Yisraelite, a descendant of Jacob. And because Moshe said, you're not my, in this discussion regarding the Lowi, and that's how this prophecy began. Devarim 18 begins with a thorough discussion about the Lowi, the prophet would be from another tribe. And after announcing that he will be a Navi by indicating that he would be similar to me, Moshe was revealing that he would be supremely intelligent. Now, let's make no mistake about it. Moshe was brilliant. Moshe was also a great writer and orator. I know that it says that he had a thick tongue and probably was not the most crisp presenter of words, which is exactly as Yahweh wanted it. He picked someone whose diction was not ideal to introduce his name to the world to disprove that this notion that we don't know how to say God's name correctly or precisely, so we should not irritate him by saying it imprecisely. Well, that's pretty much destroyed by the realization that God picked Moshe, who claimed to have a speech issue, convey his name to us. But Moshe, make no mistake, was supremely intelligent. He was a great writer. The Ba'alim is spectacular oratory. He was a wonderful leader, a spectacular liberator, someone who was chosen and equipped by Yahweh to shepherd his flock. Apart from Moshe, there's only one other such man. Note, David. He alone rose up to stand up for God's people, establishing and encouraging Yisrael. And through his words, the people rise up and are restored. Moreover, what he has done, he will do again. Now, we'd be wise to listen to Yosha ben Nun, to Samuel, to Yeshayah, to Yirmiyah, to Hosha, to Yaketzel, as we are to Dode. But they are not actually comparable. Dode did not speak of Yosha ben Nun, of Yeshayah, Yirmiyah, Hosha, Yaketzel, but they all spoke of him. Dode's life and lyrics go well beyond providing a prophetic narrative regarding the future of Yisrael, because he is Yisrael. He is, as I have mentioned, the living embodiment of the covenant. He is the Son of God. He is the shepherd we are afforded the opportunity to follow into the promised land. And he is our king. Once we are there, Dode is our guide. He is our mentor. He is our counselor, our brother, our Messiah, our shepherd, and our king. His words are more prolific than any other. But more than this, Dode is Yahweh's answer to the people's problems. Their preference to listen to a man speak of God rather than directly from God. As the man Yosha chose and anointed to inspire and enlighten his people, Dode is Yahweh's retort to Yisrael's response. And from God's perspective, it would be better, more appropriate to address the wayward nation through him. I think we can say with a significant degree of confidence that of all the people who have ever lived, Yahweh is most like Dode. Now, I understand Yahweh is far more magnificent than was Dode. But of all the men who ever lived, if you were looking for a personality, a character, an attitude, an aptitude that was the most similar to God among men and women, Dode. Yahweh brought Dode out of obscurity. He raised him above all Yisrael. He established him as the Mashiach, Ra'ah, Ben, and Melech, as well as his Nabi. God placed his words in his mouth, evidence of which we find throughout the Mizmor and Mashal, as he sang them to us. God's son followed his father's footsteps, doing as Yahweh instructed. And because of this, God is expecting us to know what he wrote for us to read. His words, after all, define the relationship Yahweh wants to achieve. Whose name is mentioned the most in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms?
God, of course. I mean, Yahweh and then those.
Yahweh, 7,000 times. Mm-hmm. Who's mentioned the third most?
Probably Moshe.
Moshe.
I'm guessing.
Yep. And who's mentioned the second most?
It has to be Dode, yeah.
Dode, by a long shot. Well over 1,000 times for Dode. Not even a comparison to anyone else. It is essential that we come to recognize and accept Dode's unique position in the heart of Yahweh's story. You know, when I was asked the other day, we took an outing on the boat, appropriately named Kara, with my Labrador, appropriately named Asher, my wife, appropriately named Leia. You can see I have bought into story. You know, chose the name Yada and then applied it to the series as Yada Yahweh. So you can
and so do Yahweh.
Yeah, you can accuse me of being biased. I certainly am. But while we were talking, one of the guests said, "So has over these this course of the 20 years you've written all these books. Now you're going back and re-editing them. Has someone that is has read your books?" pointed out something to you that completely changed your viewpoint, that had a profound impact on what you thought to be accurate, so that you rewrote your books based upon what somebody who had read them came to recognize was incorrect about what you had previously said. And, well, the fact checkers that scour each chapter that I write will say, oh, what you wrote there is not true. It's always in a detail, you know, and you're just, okay, somebody asked that this is the first mention of such and such was actually the most infamous mention. There was a mention previous that I had written in and then I wrote out. That's just not substantial enough to include, but details. But the answer to that question is no. Not in 21 years. And what we went on to say is that his follow-up question was, well, you're rewriting all these books. Why? And I said, one reason. Really, one reason. The recognition of who Dode is and God's plan. Because it changes everything. Now you know who the Son of God is. Now you know who the Messiah is. Now you know who's returning. Now you know what's important to read and what's not. And now you know why Shaul is the plague of death and the Dode is the source of life.
Okay.
When you come to appreciate Dode's role, it changes the perspective that you look at these words. And so just that alone, it's going to be over 3 years of my life to rewrite the 25 volumes of Yada Yahweh. It's been a pleasure to do it. I've learned so much. I'm delighted that the occasion has occurred. But genuinely, it was prompted by the recognition of Dode. Because once you recognize who Dode is, God's chosen people are waiting for their own to return.
Yeah.
They didn't fail to recognize the Messiah. The Messiah is Dode. God didn't turn on them because they killed him. The one who was killed is the Passover lamb. He came to be killed. Jews have made a terrible mistake. They have denied the Passover lamb. That's the conclusion of the 88th Mizmor that is so telling. The greatest mistake in the history of God's people is the failure to recognize what Yahweh did for them on Pesach and Matzah in year 4000 Yah. Their vehement denial of it. But with Dod being the Messiah, with Dod being the Son of God, with Dod being the King of Kings, then the story concludes where it began, with the chosen people, with the most chosen individual among the chosen people. And so it brings us back to the entire focus of Yada Yahweh is Yahweh revealing himself to Yisrael. And you come to that appreciation when you come to know exactly Dod's role in this story and why Dabarim 18 is so essential. With Dabarim 18 and this prophecy about the coming one, then there is no justification whatsoever for Christian New Testament. Yahusha is nothing more, nothing less than the Passover lamb. The story is about Dod. It is essential, really, that we come to appreciate his position in the heart of Yahweh's story. He arose 3,000 years after our exit from Eden, and he will be returning in year 6,000 Yah, 6,000 years from our expulsion into Eden to open its door to the garden once again. He has always been our shepherd. Those who do not recognize him as such will not be recognized or accepted by Yahweh. You reject a man's son, and you have slapped him in the face. And that's the moral of this story. It's why Yada Yahweh leads through observations to coming home where Dod's, Mashal, and Mizmor are king. Now, what follows may sound harsh, but these words are words the world needs to hear. They're directed principally at the likes of Paul, Akiva, and Muhammad, giving us the means to identify and disregard false prophets. It reads, with absolute certainty, nevertheless, the person who proclaims a message on behalf of a deity, who deliberately oversteps their bounds and speaks arrogantly and presumptuously, defiantly concocting a rebellious scheme for the express purpose of conveying words under my reputation and designation, which I have not expressly appointed, taught, authorized, or directed him to convey, or who speaks in the name of other and additional gods, then that prophet is actually deadly. Dabarim 18:20. Among the most profoundly important statements ever inspired by God. He has given you the means to know what he inspired and what he has not. This statement tells you that the Quran is rubbish and must be thrown away. It tells you the Christian New Testament is counterproductive and deadly and must be discarded. Tells you that the book of Enoch is trash. Well, I know such men, as do you. Paul was the worst of them, followed by Akiva, Muhammad, and Maimonides. But the list of men who have claimed God's authority for their edicts and actions is long, and it includes the leaders of Greece and Rome, the kings of Assyria and Babylon, Roman Catholic popes, Jewish rabbis and the royal despots who ruled over Europe, China, Asia, South and Central America, and the Middle East. Those who have read Mein Kampf recognize that even Hitler could be included among the infamous. Shaul Paul, the orator, author, and inspiration behind the Christian New Testament, was the most egregious and obvious offender. He was also the most defiant and deadly, especially in his assault against Jews. The self-proclaimed apostle was arrogant by his own admission. He seethed in rage against God's chosen people, writing horrible things about them, which would haunt them for two millennia. In a fit of anger, he even condemned three of Yosha's disciples. Paul was prone to exaggeration, falsely claiming 99.9% of the world's population for himself. And he was a schemer, devising the most devilish plots against Yahweh's covenant, his Torah, his feasts, his Shabbat, even against circumcision, the sign of the covenant. In direct violation of this exhortation and prophecy, Paul boastfully, presumptuously, claimed to speak for the God he continually contradicted, the God he errantly cited, the God he routinely misconstrued. What he said and wrote, rather than being inspired by God, was actually diametrically opposed to what Yahweh had instructed in his Torah. Paul also promoted the names of false gods, writing in the name of the Lord, quoting Dionysus, while basing his gospel on the Greek charities and the Roman graces. Even his Iesu Christu was bogus, serving as a replacement for the God Paul despised. As a consequence of not recognizing that Shaul was the plague of death, the world's most anti-Semitic religion took root, and it grew, leading to countless pogroms and eventually to the Holocaust. If only there had been a Torah observant Jew with the intellect and character to compare what Paul said and wrote to this declaration within the Torah that he was obviously violating, a New Testament would not have been added to what was deemed now to be old. One, Hebrew. Systematically compared this statement in the Torah to what Paul promoted. It would have been over.
Yeah, amazing, isn't it? Wow.
Zed is an especially provocative term. It serves as the juxtaposition of arrogance and exaggeration in this prophecy, presumptuousness and contempt, uncontrollable rage and scheming deliberation, audacious disrespect, and mean-spirited rebellion. Zed also addresses what we would call deliberate defiance of intentionally scheming against Yahweh. Now, having studied Paul, having written extensively about his egotistical plot to undermine the Torah, the Beret, the Mikra, and Yehudim, and establish the audacious notion of a new covenant, one based upon placing one's faith in the gospel of grace, I recognize that Zed's every nuance serves to indict the founder of the Christian religion. That's not to say that everything Paul wrote was false. Had it been, he wouldn't have fooled anyone. It isn't how false prophets prevail. Effective deceptions always derive their perceived legitimacy from something which has been established. For example, Muhammad is called a prophet because only credible aspects of the Quran are those he plagiarized from the Torah and prophets. So the only reason he's called a prophet is because he pilfered from, via the Talmud, arguments that appear to be justified. And therefore, he's compared to the others. But guess what? Just because his ego wouldn't allow him to be anything less, neither he nor Paul got a single prediction right. Muhammad's not a prophet. Not one prediction right. Paul got many wrong. So did Muhammad. In God's test, you have to get all of them right and can't get any of them wrong. Muhammad wasn't a prophet. Paul wasn't a prophet. Not one by either man. If you are Yah's prophet, everything you reveal must be entirely consistent with what Yahweh has Sawa instructed, Torah, fashioned the covenant, and directed the feast. If every word isn't inspired, accurate, and authorized, then the prophet is false. There's no room for any deviation, any personal indulgence, any opinions, or so much as a single contradictory statement. I got news for all those numbskulls out there, the Joseph Smiths who's going to spend his eternity in hell, or these people who consider themselves to be prophets. Not only are they not prophets, but that is a really bad choice because there's nothing God despises more. You do not want to make that claim. The standard, apart from being a real prophet, is you have no chance whatsoever to meet it. I am so glad that Yahweh has gone to such length to describe the witness that he would use to awaken his people. And at no time does he even come within a million miles of calling such individual a prophet. But why would you want to be a prophet?
You don't need a prophet.
You know, there's enough prophetic insights that have been revealed to fill 1,000 lifetimes. At this point, the volume of Yad HaYah set just spine to spine is over 3 feet. And I'm going to tell you that the entire review of everything that Yahweh said in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is only about 2 inches. And yet we have 30 feet, and we've just barely scratched the surface. And the reason for that is it's the insights that you derive from these words and the explanation of the words and all the depth and richness of the meaning of these words and how they apply to our lives that is so essential for us to know. And that is so much more fun, so much more productive at this time than having another prophet. Why in the world would we have another prophet? God's told us the beginning, the middle, and the end. Even repeated himself.
Right.
I'm sorry, editors. God's told us the story every which way possible. I know when he's coming back, so do you. You know exactly the minute and the hour of the day and year that he is returning and why and with whom. And you know all the stuff that's going to go wrong between now and then. And you know how to be there with him when he returns as one of his children. We know all of this. God told us all this. The world doesn't need another prophet. It needs to listen to the prophets God's already provided.
I need to just read this.
Yes. I'm not suggesting that this is the only answer. You know, it may be now. But, you know, as time grows, there may be other witnesses, but at least there's one. And that's all God has ever promised. And sadly, for a very long period of time, from Malaki really till the end, there are no more prophets. Malaki was the last of them. 2,500 years of prophetic silence. I think Yahweh was speaking very loudly, very clearly, very powerfully, very urgently to his people. But it's through the prophets of old that the message is finally resonating. So, God is abundantly clear about who is and who is not a prophet. He communicates with people. He is exceedingly disciplined to explain when they're deployed, where they're deployed, why they're being deployed, and to whom they're speaking. And in this regard, there isn't a single rabbinical affirmation anywhere to be found in the Torah or throughout the prophets. Not once does God say, I'm going to inspire a gaggle of rabbis, and they're going to go write a Talmud and a Mishnah and a Zohar, and they're going to create this really nifty religion called Judaism, which I'm going to inspire and support. The thing that is so essential to the identity of Jews, Judaism, God never speaks of in a positive way. Condemns it a lot. Isn't that amazing? You got all these rabbis that are claiming to speak for God, and God never said a word about them other than to condemn them. Said nothing about their festivals. Said nothing about their books. Condemn them. And yet he speaks vociferously of the goy that he would pick to awaken his people. I would be circumspect if I were you, if you are a religious Jew, to that realization. While his role as the Pesach Gael, the Passover Lamb, is well attested, Yahusha was not acknowledged by name anywhere within Yahweh's testimony, because his purpose was to fulfill prophecy, not to proclaim it. Also, Dod's name is proclaimed by the prophets more times than any other, because in addition to being the most prolific prophet, he is returning with Yahweh's Messiah and King. When a person claims God's authorization and inspiration, as Paul did, Akiba, Muhammad, and a plethora of rabbis have done, their testimony must be perfect, and yet it is seldom even correct. There can be no latitude, no compromise, no accommodation, no justification. A false prophet cannot be exonerated by pointing out that some of the things they wrote are true. It only takes a single errant stroke to impose an imposter. Their lack of respect for Yahweh's word, his name, his Torah, his covenant, his invitations, his terms, and his way individually are sufficient to denounce them all. Every prophet who spoke for Yahweh affirmed the Torah. Every single one of them. They all share God's guidance and teaching and did not amend it. They did not challenge it. They did not seek to replace it. They sought not to annul it. Their focus was always on Yisrael. Goyim were to be avoided. Within their revelation, Yahweh speaks in first person and is frequently named. No one else matters. other than to identify the cast of characters interacting with and often misleading Yisrael. The unique and enlightening nature of Hebrew stems, conjunctions, can influence the way that we convey verbs such as muth, which was the last verb in that powerful statement. In the call stem, we should perceive false prophets as being genuinely deadly and recognize that their words are actually lifeless. There is then good and bad news relative to the perfect conjugation. On the positive side, the plagues inspired by such men will not endure because God has devised a cure. But as for the liars themselves, by writing muth such that the consequence is time constrained, the false prophet's death will not be the end of their existence. And this means that Yahweh intends to dispatch such souls to Sheol, where they will remain incarcerated and separated forevermore. Since this is a life and death matter, Yahweh wants his people to be absolutely certain who was speaking for him and against him. Now, we're still recording, but no longer broadcasting. So this will be our last statement. We'll pick up again at this point next week.
Okay.
And if you say, using your best judgment, how can we actually and consistently know? Yada. The statements which, eth ha dabar ashar, Yahweh himself has not spoken. Lo dabar hu. When a prophet speaks in the reputation or designation of Yahweh, and the matter discussed has not occurred or does not come to be, this is a message that Yahweh has not spoken to him. Such a prophet has stated it arrogantly, presumptuously, and independently of his own accord. You should not revere or respect him for having conspired to incite an alienating rebellion. The Dabarim, Deuteronomy, words, 1822. The fellow that created the most popular religion amongst Gentiles in world history. The fellow that wrote the book that these faithful consider to be scripture. Wrote 14 of the letters and is the inspiration between Matthew, Mark, Luke, and the book of Acts, in addition to those 14 letters. Paul offered one prophecy. In all of that space, he offered one prophecy. It was about he calls the rapture. Harpazo, I think, is the term. It's a very violent snatching away. There is no rapture. There is a gleaning of the covenant, but it's of the existing covenant, not the new covenant. And that gleaning will take place on Teruah. Paul was writing at it, a big shot that he was, and somebody asked him when it's going to occur. And, of course, he couldn't say, I don't have a clue, because his ego wouldn't allow that. So he, he waxed poetic, and he said, when this occurs, the dead are going to rise first, and then we who are alive will follow them in a blink of an eye.
Good luck with that one.
Didn't happen, did it? In fact, it wouldn't happen for almost 2,000 years, just missed it by a smidgen. Sorry, means it's deadly.
Yeah.
The Christian malarkey will say, he was chosen by Jesus to speak for him. Oh, yeah, then why did he never once quote him accurately? And all of those 14 letters, plus everything else he did, he only quoted Yosha once, and even then he got it wrong. It was to he misquoted Yosha to create the false impression that there were two covenants. That was it. Letters are filled with "but I, Paul, say."
Yeah,
never.
Yeah, says, but I say.
But yeah. Yosha said nothing. When he quotes Yahweh, he never mentions him by name, and 100% of the time he misquotes him. Pulls the statement out of context, and 100% of the time, God's actual message is the antithesis of the point Paul's making. So I can assure you, he didn't speak for God. He did not speak for Jesus, much less Yosha. And he's a false prophet. And yet, he is the author of the most popular religion in human history. And not just the most popular religion, but the most anti-Semitic. The religion that's done more harm to God's people than any other. That's all because the people who should have known better, the people who were told better, pretended to be Torah observant and really didn't give a rat's patootie about the Torah, because if they did, they would have killed that religion right at the outset, such that by citing Devarim 18, Christianity would have been stillborn. And there's a consequence.
Yeah.
Ignorance isn't bliss. It's deadly. And the hell that Jews have endured these past 2,000 years is because the religion of Judaism was conceived at the time and for the purpose of denying the Passover lamb. And because of that, Jews have brought this hell upon themselves. Well, I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank our wonderful team that have done so much for us over these years in editing and publishing these books, and of course the enormous social outreach at this point. And to the social media that's being projected and promoted to draw attention to these works, to the website at Yada Yaa now that is so effective at communicating what we are learning as we're learning it. I go very often to the community page on the Yada Yaa website. If you go from the home on the website and you click community, the first thing that comes up is what Dee is doing for us in social media, and I strongly encourage everyone to go there and support her work there. It's how the world is communicating. It's the new town square, and it's essential that Yahweh's message be there. And Dee is doing that for us. She's working a lot with Leah and has got Jackie's support. But if you go to David, who is who has created the Yada Yaa website, and you click on the Books of Yada Yaa, that is a companion site that David has created. When you click on there, on the far right side, there's some lines and a finger, and it says the translation index. I use it every day. And I wrote these books, and I'm using it every day. Because you can go there, and you would say, all right, how many times and where have I written about such and such or translated this this particular passage? And it's all there. And it is such a marvelous tool the way that it's integrated. So really appreciative of it. And Kirk, thank you.
My pleasure.
For contributing to this program, and And I want to thank you all who are listening. And for Yahweh's chosen people, Israelites, Yehudim, God loves you in spite of yourselves. Christians are wrong. He didn't kill God. The Romans tried to kill the Passover lamb, put the Passover lamb through great misery. But they did not kill God. The Spirit of God left before the Lamb drew its last breath. But it would be in your interest to recognize that Yahushua was the Passover Lamb. He was not the Son of God. He was not the Messiah. Not a prophet. He was the Passover Lamb. And he achieved that status by God inserting his nefesh, soul, his projected consciousness into him. And that matzah was fulfilled the following day when Yahweh's consciousness, his nefesh, was sent to Sheol to redeem us, to ransom us. It is behooving for you to recognize that your Messiah has a name. His name is Dod. It's David. That he is returning with Yahweh, that Mamamedes' calendar is way off and stupidly conceived. We are just 11 years from Yahweh's return. He is going to return on the day of reconciliation. He wants to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and Yehuda. There are currently 20 books. Within a week's to 2 weeks' time, there'll be 21 on the bookshelf of Yadaya. All total, there'll be at least 25. They were all written for you. This is a labor of love because God loves his people and is trying to call you home. Listen to him. He loves you. He is exceedingly generous, compassionate. He's liberating. He's enlightening. He's uplifting. He's empowering. He's enriching. He's everything you would want a father and God to be, and nothing like what the religious have to say of him. The most anti-Semitic influence in the world today is actually rabbinic Judaism. It's not Muslims. They're a force that can be reckoned with. It's not Christians, although they have done great harm. It's not progressives, even though they are the most dim-witted of all people today. No, the most anti-Semitic force in the world is rabbinic Judaism. Does more to distance people from Yahweh's name, does more to preclude Jews from knowing that Yahweh fulfilled Pesach and Matzah leading to Bukurim, does more to corrupt Yahweh's message and to deprive Jews of their relationship with God than any other institution, now or ever. To be part of a relationship with Yahweh, as a Yehudim, the first thing you must do is walk away from Judaism. To expose it, to condemn it, to reject it. And the second is to disassociate yourself from Israeli politics. God specifically told Abraham that he must walk away from Babylon, from Babel, from the confusion of religion and politics, from that culture, from the family of man, if he wanted to journey to the promised land and be part of this covenant. If you are a Yehudim, understand what your name means. It means beloved of Yahweh. Yahweh is God's name. You must come to know it, acknowledge it, understand it, and use it, cherish it, if you're going to be part of the covenant family and survive this life. Come to trust him. Come to trust him by rejecting the lies that have been written about him and turn to his words. Yes, we write and we speak in English here as we translate the Hebrew text, because English is the lingua franca not only the world, but it's the language spoken by more Jews than any other. You're welcome to read the books of Yada Ya. You can go to yadaya.com. They're all there in their entirety free. If you prefer holding paper in your hands, the books can be bought royalty free from Amazon. Turn to them, read them, learn about your God. Embrace the covenant, attend the Mikra. And you too can be part of his eternal family. But be aware there's not much time left. Here in the late spring of 2022, you have just over 11 years, and that's for the lucky, the remnant. Two out of every three Jews will die between now and then. More, even a higher percentage of the world's population will succumb to man's horrible decisions and wars and famines and pandemics between now and then. So don't wait. And there's no value in waiting anyway. A relationship with Yahweh is marvelous. As I said, it is uplifting and liberating. It's not restrictive like religion. God doesn't have any laws. He has teaching and guidance. He is enriching, enlightening, empowering. It's fun to be around. That's the reason why I was kidding. I said, I write of God as if he were my buddy, as if he were my father. He's my friend. I think God wants us to view him that way. He wants us to be comfortable with him. So that's my invitation to you. If you are a Yahud, Jew, if you are a Israelite, from the other tribes other than Yahud, and if you're a Gentile, this message is also for you. So, Kirk, thank you. My pleasure to be with you this evening. A wonderful and happy Shabbat to one and all. Thank you for thank the you. Family members that contribute to this program with your insights and your aptitudes, as well as to the book and to the website. May Yah bless you all. Good night.
Good night.